Whose funeral is it? Yours.
Can I help you?
Yes, my name is Bond. James Bond.
Look after Mr. Bond. See that some harm comes to him.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. On this week's episode, we present part three of our projected six-part retrospective on the James Bond films. And here to discuss them with me is my regular co-host on the AU Wishbone Show and my semi-regular guest host on this show, John Ringer. Welcome back once again aboard the show, John.
Thanks for having me, Van. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, we're going to get into the Roger Moore era. We began with parts 1 and 2 covering Sean Connery and the George Lazenby film. But now we get into the swinging 1970s, a decade that you and I remember probably fondly somewhat, right? And yes. And Roger Moore really sort of symbolized in a lot of ways that era, the way that he played Bond, which was in some ways similar to what had come before, but in some ways he really kind of made it his own role. So and they had a different flavor, I think, than what had come before. You know, some would say that's good, some would say that's bad, some would say, you know, either way. So tonight what we're going to do is cover the first four of the Roger Moore movies from his unprecedented and never matched since run of 7 movies. Nobody else did 7, at least not for Eon, 7 official canonical, you know, Bond films for Eon. He's the only one. We'll be looking at 1973's Live and Let Die. Lots to say about that one. 1974, By 11 Days. I've always called this the 1975 movie, but it came out 11 days before 1975, around Christmas of 74. The Man with the Golden Gun. 1977, The Spy Who Loved Me. And 1979, Moonraker. In our next episode, which we'll do in a week or two, it will cover the remaining 3 Roger Moore films, as well as the 2 Timothy Dalton films. So we got that coming up to look forward to. And then, of course, in our last 2 episodes, we will do Pierce Brosnan and Daniel Craig. So, John, before we get going here, just totally in general, how do you what's on your mind as you look toward the Roger Moore films?
Well, I have been thinking about them a lot, knowing we were going to talk about this and going back and watching most of them. I think one of the things is the earlier Roger Moore films, he's more of a – just more of the physical James Bond stuff. Mm-hmm. And the later ones gets to be more comedy, more quips and gadgets, and less of the physical James Bond.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
He was also – you know, Bond is always this smooth, suave, sophisticated guy, and that part maybe Moore does better than anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'd agree with that absolutely.
And you know, he comes across very polished and unruffled. And I love how there's a lot of movies where he's doing something and he's wearing a suit and tie, and I'm like, why the heck? He's in some Caribbean country on some mission, and he's wearing a suit and tie all the time. But I do think the later ones, it got to be too silly and too quippy and not he wasn't tough enough or whatever, and that bothered me a little bit.
And you know, in the later ones too, he kind of it's almost like he doesn't take anything seriously.
Yes.
I mean, there's the unflappable Bond who is brave in the face of danger, and then there's Roger Moore toward the end who just almost laughs when he's presented by a, you know, by a challenge, you know. So, yeah, there's a fine line, and sometimes he kind of crosses over it. But, of course, you know, and I don't want to go too far about the later ones because we'll talk about them next time. But, you know, you got to point out, do you know how old he was when he did when the last one he did came out?
No idea.
58.
Oh, my God.
Yes. He's romancing, you know, 20-year-olds who just fall into bed with him, and he's 58 in A View to a Kill.
Okay, it makes sense.
Yeah. Well, he did do them longer than anybody else. He started in 73 and ended in 85. So in 73, he was, what, 46, which is still a little older to be starting your Bond run. But, yeah. Okay. Well, I think that what we'll do this time, last time we did our trivia, I believe, at the end, but I was thinking just to avoid, like, giving away spoilers for the trivia as we talk about them and then doing it at the end, let's do a little Bond trivia up front to kind of get the audience and ourselves warmed up, and then we'll dive into talking about those four movies. So, let me see. I've probably got several here, and we can trade back and forth a couple of times, and I might have a few more I can throw at you. But let me give you this one first, because there's no way you'll get this. Actually, I've got two.
Well, I was going to say, after having listened to your daughter name the Bond themes, I think I'm in trouble, but go ahead.
Was she amazing?
That was impressive.
Man, I'm telling you what, too. I gave her kind of easy ones around here. She could have told you some that weren't that. What blew my mind is that she knew Goldfinger, and then she knew Thunderball, which sounds a lot like Goldfinger. And she knew the difference between the two in like two notes.
That was impressive.
Yeah, she blew me away with that. I knew she'd know him, but I didn't think she'd just go like, Thunderball! okay, here, let me make a note, actually. Okay, I'm going to start you off with this one. Two really, really hard ones. First, name any Bond movie where Playboy magazine or something directly Playboy related is shown on the screen.
I'm going to guess, what's the one we just did with Las Vegas, where they go to Las Vegas?
Yes. Wow. Diamonds Are Forever. You got it. Wow. That was great. Yeah. In Diamonds Are Forever, when he kills the bad guy in the elevator on the way up to Tiffany Case's room, he switches wallets with him so it looks like he's the bad guy that's killed James Bond. You know, that's when Tiffany goes, "You just killed James Bond." And one of the things he pulls out of his own pocket is his Playboy Club membership card. Because you just know James Bond in 1971 had a Playboy Club membership, you know. The other one, as I was just rewatching on Her Majesty's Secret Service this afternoon, just to kind of catch some of that stuff that I've been hearing about it, and I'll mention something about that in a second, but on Her Majesty's Secret Service, you remember the scene where he breaks into the Swiss lawyer's office that's to kind of get on the trail of the heraldry thing to track down Blofeld, and he's got like this giant safe-cracking machine that comes in the window on a crane. Mm-hmm. So while he's sitting there working that thing, he's like unfolding a centerfold in a Playboy. And here's the best part. When he's done and he chucks the machine out the window into the crane and then he leaves the office and walks out to the elevator, he's pulled the centerfold out of the magazine and is rolling it up, putting it in his pocket. I never noticed that until today. That he actually he doesn't have the magazine. He pulls the centerfold out and rolls it up and is like sticking it in his pocket while he's leaving. I thought that was great. Speaking of which, before we get back to it, speaking of On Her Majesty's Secret Service, and that's my other really hard one, I wanted to mention a couple of things I failed to mention before. One of the things that's come to my attention through various other podcasts and sort of reading some various notes and things is – I never noticed this before, and I want to see if you ever caught your attention, because I don't know how long it's been since you saw Under Majesty's Secret Service. Was that one you watched recently?
No.
Okay. The director, Peter Hunt, was very much into like running themes through a movie. And so there's a couple of things he does all through that movie, and that's going to lead to my second big trivia question. One of the things he weaves to that movie is the color purple, because it's on Her Majesty's Secret Service, and purple's the royal color. So if you watch that movie and really pay attention, you'll see like some of the women have purple dresses on. The casino early on, the walls are purple. There's a lot of purple in that movie. The other thing that's even more pronounced is time. The whole theme of that movie is that we don't have much time in life, you know, and he has very little time with Tracy before she dies and all that. And the whole movie is like ticking down to Tracy dying, basically. You just don't know it, you know, until you finish the movie. And so I started thinking about that time is such a theme of it. And you realize that the second theme song of the movie is We Have All the Time in the World. And in the opening credits, they show Bond hanging from like the hand of a clock as it spins around. And then over and over during the movie, you'll see like the opening scene is Big Ben reflected in the gold plaque of Universal Exports, which is a clock. And then later on, when he goes to Switzerland, he hears the bells chiming, looks out the window, and there's that big clock tower in Switzerland. And then while he's working, he noticeably takes his watch off and sets it there in front of him, and you see the watch. It's just over and over and over, you see this motif of time and clocks just constantly through that movie. It's something that, you know, is very subliminal until you really start looking for it. So I just thought that was neat. Okay.
Interesting.
So that takes me to another really, really hard On Her Majesty's Secret Service question. You ready?
Sure.
Okay. In On Her Majesty's Secret Service, when Bond is taken, he beats up the flunkies of Draco. He doesn't know it's Draco yet. And he goes into Draco's, you know, palatial suite of an office room. He throws his knife across the room and hits something on the wall right behind Draco. What does he hit first? This is a multi-part question. Do you remember what he hits?
Is it a picture?
Close.
I don't remember. It was a statue or something then?
What's the motif of this movie?
Oh, a clock.
It's not a clock, though. It's another way of measuring as time goes by.
A calendar?
Calendar. He hits a calendar on the wall. What does Draco say is wrong with it? There's no way you'd remember that you haven't seen the movie.
No, before. I don't remember.
Draco looks at it, double takes, and says, "But this is September 13, not 14. And Bond says, "I'm superstitious that way." In other words, he threw it all the way across the room and hit the day after the day it was because he didn't want to hit the 13. So I thought that was pretty neat. That's pretty cool. Right. All right. Let's see. Do you have one for me?
All right. I'm from different time periods.
Okay.
What, the Israel's 1976 operation to rescue the hostages in Entebbe was named after a Bond movie.
Ooh.
What was it?
I have no idea, but I love that. That's a great little factoid.
So it has to be one before 76.
I'm going to guess Thunderball.
You are correct.
Nah, that just sounds like, yeah.
It's a good name for a code.
It's a good name for an operation. Absolutely. I love that. All right. Let me see. Sheriff J.W. Pepper, who's sort of a...
I just watched that. He's so good.
He's sort of a precursor to Sheriff Buford T. Justice in Smoking the Bandit. What two Bond films does he appear in?
One of them is Live and Let Die.
That's correct.
I can't remember the other one.
He comes right back in The Man with the Golden Gun.
Oh, he does?
He's on vacation in Thailand.
Oh.
Because when you think of Louisiana sheriffs, you think, oh, they probably go for a vacation in Thailand, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't have.
So he can cuss out the local people for not being American. I'm trying to think. Yeah, he's, you know, in fact, when I think about it, he's about the only he's not an evil henchman, obviously. He's not really he's an unusual character in the series, because usually you either have the evil henchman like Odd Job and Jaws. Mm-hmm. Or you have the helpful buddies like Karen Bay and Tiger, but he's sort of he's a good guy, but yet he's kind of at odds with Bond. You know, he's out to catch that boy, you know, so.
Well, and it's also because Bond is in America,
yeah,
you know, destroying everything while he's trying to catch the bad guys. And he represents local law enforcement. That's like, hey, you can't just come in here and blow everything up.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I think at one point he calls him a communist, which was what, you know, exactly what he would have done back in 1973. Okay, one more I've got for you from that period, and I love this question so much. We see the threat of a nuclear bomb exploding in a lot of James Bond movies, right?
Yes.
And like probably a third of them, it seems like, they're trying to stop a bomb. Okay. In only one Bond movie that I know of, do the nuclear warheads actually explode? Name it. That's a good question, isn't it?
Moonraker?
Oh, no. You're close. You're you're about as close as you can get, and that's a good guess, but no.
All right. What is it then?
Here's a hint. They blow each other's launching ships up. They're retargeted. Submarines.
I can't remember. Is it Tomorrow Never Dies?
No. We're Spy Who Loved Me.
Oh, Spy Who Loved Me. Yes, okay, you're right. I got it.
I just love it. They actually blow up two nuclear warheads in that movie, you know, in the middle of the ocean, I guess, to no ill effect. Other than blowing up each other's submarine, but yeah. I remember watching it going, hey, that's the only time they actually set one of those things off because nobody was nearby. So you have any more for me?
I got one more for you.
Okay.
The theme for the – what's the name of the theme song for The Spy Who Loved Me?
Ah, yes. That's a very good question. The Spy Who Loved Me is one of the few – that the theme song is not named after the movie.
That's right. It's not in the name of the movie.
It's in the lyrics, but it's not the name. It's I get it in the Octopussy when confused because it's the same way. Nobody does it better.
Yes.
All right. Had to dodge a bullet on that one because I kept thinking of All Time High. You know, the Rita Coolidge one on Octopussy is All Time High, which is similar. So. All right, so that was fun. Let us dig on now into 1973. I'm going to go ahead and make sure I introduce these because I always, if you notice in the last two episodes, I was able to get the audio clips of the trailers. I thought that's kind of fun, so I'm going to do that going forward. So here is 1973's Live and Let Die, the first Roger Moore Bond.
Roger Moore is James Bond, 007, in Ian Fleming's Live and Let Die.
My name's Bond. James Bond.
Names is for tombstones, baby. Waste him, now.
James Bond is back, and wherever he drops in, it can mean only one thing.
Trouble!
This is the Bond adventure with more excitement, more action, more danger, and more. Much more. Roger Moore as James Bond, 007.
They live and let die. They live and let die.
Double O 7 is on a worldwide manhunt. The body count is going up. And where Bond stops the visit, he leaves his mark on everything.
They'll kill you.
They will kill us. Lovers' lesson number two, togetherness.
Is there time before we leave for lesson number three?
Absolutely.
Be joined together
because Bond is on the move. And if you miss this one, you'll miss the most exciting 007 adventure of them all.
Thank you.
Okay, and that's cool. So, Live and Let Die. You got to admit, right up front, there's two really standout things about Live and Let Die. One of them, it's the first Roger Moore. Okay, so you're going to a whole new Bond. And you know, you get the sense with Moore, this isn't going to be a George Lazenby where he's going to do one, and then there's going to be all kind of contention between the actor and the producers. Roger Moore must be like the easiest person to get, the most professional actor on earth, the easiest to get along with. He settled in for a long run, and I think that was pretty obvious from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about Live and Let Die is it really stands out to me, and I want to get your thoughts on this. It really stands out to me as very different from most other Bonds because of all the sort of supernatural stuff, the voodoo stuff, the African-American, you know, presence being so large, Harlem and New Orleans and all, almost like a Haiti. How do you feel about this movie in terms of how different it is?
It is different because of the supernatural stuff. And that part, I don't think was that shocking, but it's the part of it, this movie. If it wasn't a James Bond movie, it could have just been like a regular blaxploitation movie from the 1970s, like a lot of other kind of movies at the time, and it had a lot of the same things in it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But so that was the big thing to me. But then also the supernatural thing where, you know, you think he's killed the guy, and then the guy shows back up and that kind of stuff, so.
Yeah. I really think that there's two things about the bad guys in this movie that really stand out to me. One, I think that Yaphet Kotto is a great Bond villain. I think he's very underrated in this. He gets kind of an ignominious death, you know, kind of a silly precursor to Roger Moore's later ways of killing people. But I wish that Kananga could have been killed in a little more conventional way. You know, I mean, I can see they were trying for something clever, but it really just kind of came off goofy.
No, I thought it was, I mean, but he was a great villain.
Yeah. Oh, Kotto, he's a great actor. You know, he later appeared in Alien. He was one of the guys, you know, trapped on the ship. I love Yaphet Kotto. And I love that he was like a dual villain. He was both the American drug gangster Mr. Big, which is how he is in the Ian Fleming novel, but also he was this smooth Caribbean island dictator, Dr. Kananga. Mm-hmm. I mean, that just rang so true for me that he's at the UN making speeches with his entourage and spouting all this political stuff, you know, to the microphones that are listening to him in his office and everything. I mean, I just really like the idea that he's both Mr. Big and Dr. Kananga, and people hadn't figured that out until he pulled his makeup off. You know, that was pretty cool. Also, I think he doesn't have maybe the single best henchman. There's other henchmen certainly that are probably better, but I think that Kananga has the best overall group of henchmen of any of the Bond movies. What do you think about his henchmen?
I think that's pretty fair because he has
so many.
He has a lot. I mean, he has the guy who's the voodoo witch doctor guy.
Yeah, that's Baron Samedi.
And then he has the guy with the claw hand.
That's
Teehee. And then he has
and they're all so unusual, you know. They all have a gimmick.
Mm-hmm. Isn't there another one he fights in America too?
Well, there's Whisper, the big guy.
Whisper, the big guy.
I love how he pretends to be like the valet or whatever coming in with the and he's like, "Your dinner, sir." What's that?
I said it's your dinner, sir. Shall I open the wine?
Yes, yes. It just cracks me up when I see that scene every time because it's gone from his menacing whisper to you can't hear what he's saying. And he's
you're right. I think he has the best ensemble of henchmen.
He's also got there's the guy that drives the speedboat. We never really get much of a sense of who he is, but he was kind of like a James Brown. I mean, like a who am I trying to think of? In terms of, he was like a Shaft kind of guy, you know, the cool, suave flunky. And the other guys are just kind of odd. But I love Baron Samedi. In fact, the thing that's so cool about Baron Samedi is that all the way through it, he puts up this front that he's supernatural. And then Bond kind of tips, you know, that they're actually doing tricks to make him seem supernatural. But then at the end, he's on the train. I think that's the best ending of any Bond movie.
Yeah, I really like that.
I mean, that scared me to death when I was a little kid. I thought he's going to kind of come get me in my bed after after I went to bed after watching that movie.
I did too. This movie genuinely scared me when I was a child.
Yeah, yeah. It's I think it's the one that's the most creepy when you're especially when you're little. You know.
Yep. Well, because there's all the kind of the voodoo stuff, like you're saying, there's dancing and snakes. And,
snakes. Oh yeah. Oh, that was another one. We don't see much of him, but that guy is supposed to be called. Dang it, I can't think of his name. It's a traditional African. Dumbala. He's called Dumbala, the guy that like gets knocked into the thing with the snakes, I believe.
He wears like a mask, like a goat head or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he's another one. He had so many cool flunkies in this movie that they didn't have enough time for all of them to do something. So, and you have the alligator farm. Where they that was real when he walked, you know, jumped on the heads of them to walk out. They actually had a stuntman do that, and he had to do like 3 or 4 takes. And one of the takes, one of the alligators like grabbed his pants leg and almost got him.
Wow,
that was real. In fact, that's where they got the name Kananga. You know, in the book, it's just Mr. Big, and that was Kananga's alligator farm or something. And they're like, well, we got to use that. And they just came across it when they were scouting locations in I guess Louisiana or wherever. And they just took that name and put it in the script. So I just love that. I just think it's so cool. So, I have Live and Let Die probably up in my top 5. I just think because it's an early enough Roger Moore that he hadn't gotten silly yet. And and he's still pretty young relatively.
Yep.
Great villain, great bunch of flunkies, gorgeous Bond girl, Jane Seymour. Hadn't talked about her.
Yep. Spectacular.
Oh man. She was probably like 20 then. Man. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's still gorgeous at like whatever she is now, but my gosh, she was beautiful. And you get like the seduction where he has the tarot cards that have been printed up. I kept thinking she's going to kill him when she sees that he's rigged the deck. And he tells her later, well, I sort of, you know, stacked the deck. And she's like, it doesn't matter. Like, okay, well.
And also, the other thing is this movie has the boat chase scene is superb. So good.
There's a lot of boat chase scenes in the Bond movies, but this is a really good one, and it goes on for a long time.
It does go on. There's a lot of action in it. It goes on for a long time, and it has the whole kind of comic relief thing with the sheriff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And they jump. They had like a world record jumping the boat over the road. That was in the Guinness Book of World Records forever when I was a kid, I remember. They going up in the yard, hit the wedding or whatever. And Roger Moore, his Bond was forever disrupting weddings. There was a one in like Octopussy, I think, or View to a Kill where he disrupts a wedding too. I think of View to a Kill. Okay. Any other thoughts about Live and Let Die? Where do you have it kind of top, middle, bottom of your rankings of overall?
I have it in the top third or so. I think it's really good. I enjoy it. I also love like the tarot stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thought that was really well done. And I love we get in this run of kind of Bond movies where he's in America doing stuff.
That's true. Oh, you know, one other thing about it too, the opening scene. I mean, there's so many iconic scenes in Living Let Die. There's so many scenes that just stand out in memory, like the opening scene with the funeral in New Orleans.
Oh, yeah, the funeral parade.
The horns and the guy standing there. Yeah. Whose funeral? You know, whose funeral? Yours. And the little guy stabs him. I mean, that. And then they, you know, that, that's brilliant. I just think that's as good as anything in the series. It really is iconic and memorable and had a big impact on me when I saw it. One other last little thing is you get David Hedison, you get a different Felix Leiter in almost every movie. We get David Hedison as Felix Leiter, and he's the one they'll go back to in 1989, as we'll talk about next time, for License to Kill. Because in License to Kill, it's a very personal motivation where the Timothy Dalton Bond is at Felix's wedding to one of the Three's Company girls. And that's the actor they bring back to play Felix in a Felix-centered story. So out of all the Felix Leiters that we would ever see, this is the one from Live and Let Die that comes back again like 16 years later to be Felix again in that movie. So that was pretty cool too.
That's cool.
All right. So the very next year, but only 11 days before 1975, I think of this as the 1975 Bond movie. But some folks corrected me this week that it's actually 1974. It came out in the late December, so close enough, is The Man with the Golden Gun.
A What do you know about a man called Scaramanga?
The man with the golden gun. He always uses a golden bullet.
This trinket set with a note requesting special delivery to you.
I've never seen Mr. Scaramanga. Mr. Bond, this is impossible. I can't...
I can't tell you. Don't kill me.
Who?
Scaramanga.
Roger Moore, back in action in the exotic East as James Bond, 007, on a collision course with the most dangerous man alive. The man with the golden gun.
Hold on, sir.
James Bond, on the job. The girls are willing.
I dreamed about you setting me free.
The pace is killing.
Good night. We've got you spotted.
How about demonstration, boy?
Certainly, sir.
You'll meet old friends and new enemies. It's non-stop Bond. The action is spectacular.
You're not.
I sure am, boy.
Reaching a new high for 007.
Bonjour, Monsieur Bond. I am Nick Nat. Monsieur Scaramanga will welcome you personally.
Target is the highest-priced killer in the world. He plays a deadly game, and the stakes are sky-high.
Now, this one, everything that Roger Moore sort of set up in Live and Let Die, he almost squanders, in my opinion, in this movie. This had so much potential. This movie, Man with the Golden Gun, has so much potential because you have one of the great villain actors of all time, Christopher Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the name of his character, Scaramanga. That's just awesome. That's a great name for a Bond villain, Scaramanga. He's the man with the golden gun. He's got the cool gun he builds out of a cigarette lighter and a pen and all that, you know. I mean, so much was – and he has a base island of his own with Tattoo from Fantasy Island running around.
Whose name is Nick-Nack.
Nick-Nack, yeah. I totally think that this movie – was where Fantasy Island came from. I think that some Hollywood producer saw The Man with the Golden Gun and said, what if the Christopher Lee character was a good guy and people went to that island to live out their fantasies and we still keep Hervé Villechaize running around as like the little assistant? And seaplanes come flying in like Bond did, you know. Because Fantasy Island and The Man with the Golden Gun are basically the same, except that Mr. Rourke doesn't shoot people. That's the only difference.
Not a big difference.
No. As far as we know, and it's Ricardo Montalban instead of Christopher Lee. I bet they offered the role to Christopher Lee. Even wears a white suit like Christopher Lee. So, okay, so The Man with the Golden Gun. What are your impressions thinking back to this movie?
Well, like you said, I think about the big scene at the end where Bond and Christopher Lee have a duel, basically,
yeah,
where they're on the beach and they have their pistols and, you know, they basically have a duel and they end up having a shootout like in a funhouse area with mirrors and
right,
funky mirrors and all that kind of stuff. And that's how Bond kills him.
Mm-hmm.
And also think about I'd forgotten that you mentioned the sheriff was in there. That I know they spend a lot of time in different places in Asia.
Yes.
Hong Kong and Bangkok and places. And there's chase scenes in there. And the other thing is Scaramanga is trying to get some kind of solar-powered device called the Solex or something. And I remember there's a bunch of chasing around trying to get that. And basically the whole thing is set up because Scaramanga threatens Bond by sending him a golden bullet.
Or so we think. But, of course, right. The twist is it's Maude Adams sent it because she wants Bond to come and kill Scaramanga. Mm-hmm. But by the time Bond kind of figures that out, the Scaramanga has already killed Maude Adams. So, oh, by the way, Maude Adams is, I guess, the only Bond girl that's appeared twice, and both in Roger Moore ones. She was she was Andrea Anders in this one, mm-hmm. and then she comes back as Octopussy. So she must have had a real positive impression on the producers to bring her back in an even bigger role, because she gets killed off relatively quickly in this one. She Scaramanga figures out she's kind of working against him, and that's pretty much the end of it. Remember, this is the scene where they go to like a boxing match or a wrestling match, mm-hmm. and Bond comes up and she's just staring straight in the distance and realizes she's been shot by the golden gun.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hervé Villechaize, Nick Nat, comes up like under the seat with his gun. Do not move, monsieur. he's like, whoa, where'd that voice coming from? Coming from under my butt. And he's got his popcorn or whatever he's eating, his peanuts. There's a lot to like about that movie, but there's so many just goofy you're starting to see the more goofiness start to come out. Like,
absolutely.
At one point, they chase Christopher Lee, and honestly, Christopher Lee, it takes somebody with the gravitas and the stature of Christopher Lee to have Hervé Villechaize in a matching white suit running along beside him and still look classy. You're getting awfully close to Big Enos and Little Enos in Smokey and the Bandit at that point.
You're right. It really was a very silly kind of car chase thing, like out of something like that.
And they jump. They go in the car, and it comes out of the barn and sprouts wings and flies, and it's like a pacer.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an AMC pacer, and it pops out wings and flies off. And you get, I think, the first of many double takes by somebody in a Roger Moore movie. Roger Moore's movies immediately start doing this thing where there's like a guy drinking, and then he sees something that Bond is doing or one of the villains, and he looks at his drink and throws it down like it's out of a Bugs Bunny cartoon. Oh gosh, it's charming, and yet it just makes your teeth grind, you know. So,
well, the 20th time they do something like that, it makes your teeth
grind. Right. So, yeah, I mean, on balance, it's not in my upper half. It's and plus Goodnight is really annoying. Poor little I gotta switch to the one moment. Poor little Britt Eklund. Poor little Britt Eklund as Goodnight, Mary Goodnight, his assistant, mm-hmm. who just blunders her way through every scene, Oh, but wait, I have to admit, there is one really great scene with her and Maude Adams. And that is when Bond is just about to get Goodnight into bed, and then Maude Adams comes to the door, and Bond knows that that's business, right? He's got to seduce her to get the information about Scaramanga. So mm-hmm. do you remember what they do with Goodnight?
mm-hmm.
He stuffs her in the closet.
Mm.
And so he's like, sleeping with Maude Adams all night while little Britt Eklund is in the closet just fuming.
Mm.
and Bond goes and opens the door the next morning, and she's asleep in the closet. So, yeah, I mean, there's just, cute little things, silly little things through it. What's kind of your verdict overall on The Man with the Golden Gun?
I mean, it had a lot of potential, like you're saying, and Christopher Lee was a great villain, but it's not a great, one of the better movies.
I wish they would redo it. I mean, I know that they're not really exactly redoing Bond now with the new series.
Daniel Craig. Well,
since they rebooted it with
sure.
Casino Royale, basically, it was a hard reboot with Daniel Craig. But since then, they're not exactly remaking the old movies, but they certainly are kind of going back and revisiting. I mean, basically, Vesper dying in Casino Royale is this Bond's version of Tracy dying in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, you know. And so if they're going to do that, I wish they would come back and do it. And I've suggested a couple of actors. I would love to see like Benedict Cumberbatch as Scaramanga maybe or something.
Sure.
He's kind of overdone, I know, but I would enjoy that. So, all right. Well, we'll roll over into 1977 and this is actually kind of funny what happens in terms of other movies that influenced the Bond series. The Bond series had been innovative, but now in the 70s, it gets very reactive to what other franchises and movies are doing. So 1977, we get one of the biggest Bond movies to that point, The Spy Who Loved Me.
It's the biggest. It's the best. It's Bond. And beyond.
James Bond and the woman is Major Masova, a Russian agent. Let them get ashore and then kill them.
And Moscow will cease to exist.
He has Anya on there.
I know, James. I'm sorry.
I have to get her off.
How?
British agent in love with a Russian agent.
Your time's running out, Stromberg.
Yours too, Mr. Bond. Yours too.
It's the biggest. It's the best. It's Bond. And beyond.
Okay, so The Spy Who Loved Me, in 1975, Jaws had come out, the shark movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Bond has to have a Jaws, but it's, of course, Richard Kiel with the big metal teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And so if this movie is remembered for anything, it's like a car that turns into a submarine and Jaws, right?
That's it.
Yeah. In fact, I think that Stromberg, the main villain, is only in like two scenes and he never even leaves his dining room or even gets up out of his chair in the entire movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't do anything. But Jaws does quite a bit. this movie, you know, they had to have a Jaws, and what's ironic is they put the 1975 sensation Jaws as a character in this 77 movie. And when it comes out, it ends up going up against and competing against what movie?
I don't know, Jaws 2?
Star Wars. And so that's going to explain Moonraker 2 years later, right? Because they've got to do a sci-fi movie. So, well, in any case, 1977, The Spy Who Loved Me, an underwater movie. You have Barbara Bach is brought in as, you got to love this, Agent Triple X.
Mm-hmm.
How anybody in this movie calls her Agent Triple X and keeps a straight face is beyond me. I don't see how they do it. Walter Gotell, and I got something to say about him in a second, he had a recurring role as like the Soviet general, you know, mm-hmm. I'd have been like, send in Agent Triple X. sorry, do it again.
Take two.
Send in Agent Triple. I can't do it. That would have been me if I were Walter Gotell. Yeah, I wanted to say something quickly about Walter Gotell. Do you remember this guy? He's kind of like the bald guy with glasses that plays a Soviet general.
He plays General Gogol.
Yeah, and he's in like five or six of them, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
And he's what's funny is he's really likable and he's mostly a good guy. He's never really a bad guy in any of these. You know, he like hangs out with M in half of them.
Well, he's the one, you know, they're the ones that, you know, they're reasonable ones as opposed to the supervillains, and they make a deal and stuff.
Right, so. All the supervillains, it seems like, are trying to make it look like, you know, the Russians are doing something bad to start a nuclear war or something. And he's like the reasonable Russian guy that comes over and is like, oh, we're not doing this, you're not doing this, you know. So he sends Agent Triple X and the British send Bond. A new era of Anglo-Soviet cooperation, you know. So, but see, you get this, you know, in the opening scene, you get Bond kills her boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the same sort of plot that's been done a million times, including famously in The Guns of Navarone. It's the exact same subplot as in The Guns of Navarone, where one character on a mission tells the other character on the mission, when this is over, I'm going to kill you.
Yep.
And so she tells Bond that, and of course he has Commander Bond, you have the remainder of the film to seduce this woman so she doesn't kill you. And so he gets to work on that. But you know, I kind of liked Barbara Bach as Agent Triple X. What did you think about her?
No, she was good. She wasn't helpless.
Right. That's true.
So many of the recent Bond girls in the movies leading up to this one had been just helpless.
Oh, poor Goodnight was hopeless.
Well, and then what's her name in Live and Let Die?
Mm-hmm. Solitaire.
Yeah, she was helpless. Yeah. So you know, this girl is capable.
Oh, yeah. She knocks Bond out a couple of times.
That's what I'm saying. And when they're fighting Jaws, she does her part.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know what is funny, too? Jaws gets absolutely goofy in Moonraker. But he's not – he has a couple of goofy scenes in this one, but they're not bad yet. He's still pretty scary in this one, don't you?
He's menacing.
Yeah. Like in Moonraker, as we're going to see in a minute, in Moonraker, they put him in menacing situations, and then it turns goofy by the end.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one, he's still pretty scary. You know, I remember seeing this when I was about 9 in the theater. This was the first one I saw in the theater. And Jaws scared me to death, pretty much.
Sure.
Yeah, my little story about that is my family, you know, we lived in a small town in Alabama. We would get movies a year after they came out in our little one-screen theater. So going on a vacation to some other part of the country was like a big chance to see some movie way before we'd get to see it at home. And of course, this was 1977 in the summer. I was desperate to see Star Wars. I was just dying to see Star Wars. And we get down to Florida, and my brother is like, oh, the new James Bond movie, The Spy Who Loved Me. We got to go see that. And I'm like, no, I want to see Star Wars. So of course, we went and saw The Spy Who Loved Me. So I've never forgiven him for that or my parents. And I didn't get to see Star Wars until like 6 months later. So dang it. But, yeah, so I had that against this movie for a long time, but judged on its own merits, I think it's a pretty good one. How do you rate it?
I think it is pretty good. I mean, I think Jaws is great. Like you said, the overall villain is I didn't even remember what his name was until you said it.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, he has this underwater base. Place where he lives, Atlantis' base, and they're going to blow up the world and live down there. And he has this great aquarium and stuff. But, you know, the other thing I remember about this movie is the car, you know.
Yeah.
He has a Lotus that turns into a submarine, the White Lotus. Mm-hmm. He drives off the dock and it turns into a submarine, and that's really cool.
That's pretty cool.
I mean, it's a great scene.
Well, I give Stromberg credit for one thing. He does have sharks. You know, you can't get into the Bond Villains Club if you don't have a pool full of sharks to feed people to.
Or, well, you can't be a villain in an ocean lair.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, and at one point toward the end, Jaws is actually thrown into the shark pool and eats the sharks. That's when he starts to get a little, you're like, okay, all right, you know, okay. But yeah, this one had a good plot. I mean, it's basically You Only Live Twice mixed with The Spy Who Loved Me. You know, it's you've got the bad guy in his base who's going to who's threatening to set off nuclear warheads, although he's not doing it to blackmail, you know, extort anybody. He just wants to do it. He wants to kill everybody on Earth and have an underwater kingdom with nobody on the surface left. And that's, of course, a plot that's going to be copied over similarly with Moonraker, where Drax is basically Stromberg Mark II. I've always said that You Only Live Twice, The Spy Who Loved Me, and Moonraker are kind of all the same movie with slight variations, but there's a lot of overlap. I actually did a Venn diagram of the overlaps of those three movies, and I posted it on the Facebook page I started called Secret Agents and Super Spies. Let me get a plug in here real quick. If you're listening to this show and you like this kind of thing, I started a Facebook group a couple of months ago called Secret Agents and Super Spies. If you want to find it, just go to facebook.com/agents and spies. One long word, facebook.com/agents and spies. We have a nice little group there that just talks about everything from Bond to Archer to Bourne, you know, all these kind of things. So, but anyway, yeah, I mean, I like them cooperating with a Russian agent. I like the underwater base. You kind of have that You Only Live Twice ripoff where there's a ship that swallows smaller ships and they kidnap the crews, you know.
Very, very much.
Yeah. But overall, I think that this was a better entry. You know, what had happened was that The Man with the Golden Gun had not done well in the box office. And so Eon basically said, we're going to take every cent we have and make the biggest Bond movie there's ever been and spare no expense and try to save the franchise. And that's what this was. And you could, I mean, if you look at The Spy Who Loved Me compared to the ones that came before it, there really is a lot of money up there on the screen.
Sure.
The sets, the car, the submarine car, the all that stuff.
It's much better in terms of all the production value, not just exotic locations and a guy in an island base, but you know the underwater base and the ships eating the submarines and the, you know, like you said, the car. There was a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Overall, it's not in my top five probably, but it's really right up there in the upper third as far as just because of all that it does accomplish, I think. So, okay, and now we can kind of roll all that into the last of our four for tonight, because in 1977, The Spy Who Loved Me, it was a big success, and it saved the franchise, and we would have, you know, Bond would be back. James Bond will return, but it wasn't the biggest movie of the year. There was another movie that came out that blew it and everything else away that was Star Wars. And so immediately the Eon people say, let's take all this big profit we've made off of The Spy Who Loved Me and make an even bigger Bond that's even more expensive in outer space. And it just so happened, it worked out good, that there was one Ian Fleming novel with a slightly space-related plot and title.
From the most exotic locations on Earth, Moonraker will transport you to another world.
Ooh,
Holly was a warm girl, with the right connections.
Could this possibly be the moment for us to pool our resources?
We would be better off working together.
More excitement, more thrills, more spills. And guess who's dropped in for a bite? Jaws is back. To the most spectacular adventure in space, Moonraker. It's out of this world.
What exactly are you up to here, Drax? Moonraker 1, liftoff.
Moonraker 2, liftoff.
Moonraker 3, liftoff.
Moonraker 4, liftoff.
Entire city in space.
James Bond and the treacherous Dr. Goodhead. Despite your efforts, my finely wrought dream approaches its fulfillment.
And that was Moonraker. And it's the third novel, but they'd never done it. And so 1979, in fact, did you know this? At the end of The Spy Who Loved Me, up through 1977, at the end of The Spy Who Loved Me, all the Bond movies said James Bond will return in, and they named the next movie. Do you know what the last line of The Spy Who Loved Me is on the screen? It says James Bond will return in For Your Eyes Only.
Really?
And then came Star Wars, and they said, let's push that one back to 1981 and go ahead and do Moonraker.
Interesting.
So after Moonraker, they quit saying in. It just says James Bond will return. Because they're afraid of messing up again like that. They want to have the options to change their mind. So they decide to go with this. But rather than use anything like, you know, the I haven't read the book, but I know enough about it. I'm reading the Bond books now. I've read two of them, but I haven't read Moonraker yet. But what I understand is that a lot of it is sort of, it's like this British guy, Drax, who's going to threaten, like, blackmail London with a nuclear missile or something. So they threw that completely out. You do have Drax, but other than that, nothing really, you know, survives. But I got a good bit to say about Moonraker. I think you probably do too. What did you think about Moonraker when it came out? Did you see it in the theater?
Yes.
Okay. A lot of people did. It made a lot of money. It didn't break. It didn't, you know, it wasn't the humongous hit they hoped it would be, but I don't think they lost any money on it. It did pretty well. And then they went back to the smaller ones, obviously, with For Your Eyes Only. But what were your initial reactions to Moonraker?
I mean, parts of it were really cool. I mean, but also parts of it were very goofy. Yes. Like you said, the Jaws stuff got goofy. Yeah. I mean, there were some great scenes. Yeah. There's a great jungle boat chase scene.
Oh, yeah.
I just love that. And there's some great fights with, you know, with Jaws. You know, but then the stuff in outer space was kind of meh, you know? Yeah. The space shuttle stuff. What did you think?
Well, let's break it down, because this movie really is in kind of like two or three completely different sections. You know, it's like different movies. It has some of the best locations, I think, of any of the movies, even before they go into outer space. I mean,
absolutely.
You go out to California and you have basically the Biltmore, you know, that gigantic mansion with all the astronauts training on the lawn and everything. And they fly around the helicopter and you see everything. And I love that. I love all the scenes there. There's some stuff that doesn't make sense, like where he just shoots the guy in the tree and nobody says anything, you know. I mean, but that kind of stuff happens in all the movies just about. So I'm willing to forgive that. Bond is forever killing a flunky and nobody cares, you know.
Leaves the body.
Oh, they do that in all of them. It just, you don't ask why, just go with it, right? But yeah, I love the scenes in the big mansion where he's sneaking around, breaking into the safe, seduces the French lady that's the pilot of the helicopter and everything. I love all that. Then he goes to Venice. And that has, you know, again, that's a great location. It's a beautiful place. We don't see it again, I guess, until Casino Royale at the end. You have the fight in the glass factory.
Yes,
with the kung fu guy. You have that great scene. I love it. The great scene where he sneaks into the lab where they're making the poison gas. Mm-hmm. And as the scientists are coming back, he sets one of the vials like on the side of a little table. Mm-hmm. And when the scientists go back in there and seal the door, they bump into it and it falls on the floor and they look down and they're like, ah! And then they start melting, you know. And he's just like standing there in the window going, what the crap is this? Look, watching them, you know, and they're looking at him like, ah, as they die. And he's like, well, this is dangerous, you know. And I also love that he has the whole fight in the glass factory with that vial in his pocket and it never breaks.
Yes. Yes, that is. I'd forgotten that part. That is so good.
Everything else glass in that room breaks except the vial of deadly poison gas in his pocket while he's flying around being thrown through things and landing on, you know, the floor.
That's right.
So it's a great bit in Venice. But then in Venice, you also get the magical gondola.
Oh, that's right. The tricked out gondola. And, I'd forgotten that.
And you get the guy drinking the wine, looks at the bottle, looks at the thing and puts it down. And the pièce de résistance, the double-taking pigeon. Do you remember the double-taking
pigeon? Yes, now that you say that, I do remember the pigeon that looked back
at you. Oh, God. Gosh. So it's so Roger Moore. And, of course, as he's driving this gondola down the street on a hovercraft bottom, he's doing that Roger Moore kind of like raised eyebrow, bow his head, nod, you know, mm-hmm. Oh, hello, how are you? What, is something strange here? No, nothing.
Yeah, nothing to see. Yeah,
exactly. He's better than anybody at that. I mean, I give him that. He just has that dignity about him that just, you know, overcomes anything. So, all right. So then we go to Rio and you get some really cool stuff there. Now my favorite thing about the transition from Venice to Rio is that Bond kills the like samurai henchman, right? Mm-hmm. And you get this scene, this one little scene with Drax at his office desk on the phone. And, you know, all the way through it, Drax is just like so aloof. You know, I joke with Derek Ferguson on of Better in the Dark on podcast that that Drax is like the Perry Como of Bond villains. You're not even sure he's awake in all the scenes. You know, he's just the most chilled out villain ever. And yet you get this one scene where he's there at his desk and he's trying to replace his evil henchman. And he goes like this. He says, yes, I need someone else. Just, oh, well, if you can get him, then yes. And then here comes Jaws.
I'd forgotten that phone call part. I knew that Jaws replaced the other guy, but I'd forgotten that part.
Yeah, it's like there's like a fraternity of flunkies.
Oh, it's like he called the temp agency.
Yes.
Like henchmen.
Yeah, and they're like, well, we have Jaws. Oh.
Put him on the next plane.
Absolutely. Yeah, okay, I got to have him. Sure, he eats sharks. So Jaws gets involved and you get two great and terrible Jaws scenes Well, really three. I mean, one's really scary. When Bond and his little girlfriend from Rio, right, they're out in like the alleyway trying to get into a warehouse, mm-hmm. and Jaws is in the big clown suit.
Yep.
And he comes kind of slowly ambling up the alley from the parade, and she looks up and sees him and looks away, and he's getting closer. That's pretty scary.
It is very scary.
But then you get two other Jaws scenes in Rio that are just goofy. One is the awesome boat chase. How does the awesome boat chase end, John?
He goes over a waterfall, and it turns into a hang glider.
Well, Bond goes over the waterfall, turns into a hang glider. How does Jaws go over the...
Does he just ride over the waterfall?
He's freaking out, and he grabs the steering wheel and pulls it loose. And you get a close-up of Jaws looking at the steering wheel, looking up at the waterfall, and making this face like, "Doh," and then it goes over the fall.
Nice.
And then you get the cable car scene where Jaws like single-handedly stops a cable car from moving.
He bites a cable in half.
Yeah, or something like. He tries to, at least. And he goes out to the cable car. He rides the car up, jumps over, and they have a fight on top of the cable cars. It never made sense to me, by the way, that Bond tells Dr. Goodhead that it would be much safer on the outside of the cable car. I mean, it's not like it's on fire. It's just stopped.
But it's also like, where are you going to go?
Yeah, I know. He's like, well, I think we'll be safer out here, darling. And you're like, why? Because he almost falls off when Jaws attacks him. So, but anyway, yeah. So you get the cool cable car scene. But, of course, that also ends stupid with Jaws riding the cable car down the thing, trying to go faster and faster to catch up as they slide down. And he goes through the building.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes out of the rubble with the big wheel around his neck and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then to cap it all off, he meets his little girlfriend.
That's right.
Oh, the little girlfriend. I mean, I realize she's important to the plot because she likes basically gives him the reason to change sides at the end. You know, he cares about her and he doesn't want anything to happen to her and them, and so he changes sides. But what did you think about him and his little girlfriend?
I understand the plot part you're saying, but he was great when he was menacing.
Yeah,
and it made him not menacing.
No,
made him kind of, you know, sappy.
Like at one point, Bond is yelling instructions to him on how to save them,
yep.
and Jaws is like giving a thumbs up and smiling.
Yes.
What the? That's not Jaws. He's suddenly a completely different character.
No, I agree. I didn't love the transformation.
Yeah. So then they go into outer space, and I gotta tell you, I know a lot of people don't like it. And when I first saw it in the theater, I wasn't thrilled with it because after just seeing, you know, Star Wars and Battlestar Galactica, it is a little silly by comparison, but honestly, when you go back and watch it now, they used the real space shuttle. They were Moonrakers, but they were the real space shuttle design. And, you know, they had this real-looking sort of space station in orbit. They blast off those shuttles, the Moonraker shuttles, from their jungle lairs in Brazil, outside of Rio. And, I mean, I really love that. I think it looks great. I love that there's an American shuttle that comes up full of astronauts with laser guns and they fight. Mm-hmm. I love that space. It's like Thunderball in outer space at that point, you know?
It is. And I do appreciate that they use the actual space shuttle and then try to make up something.
Yeah.
Some supervillain spaceship. But also, like, the laser gun thing is a little out there. And there's a whole lot of guys, you know, get their suit punctured kind of stuff in outer space.
That's true.
But I mean, it was a very different, you know, kind of Bond battle. I mean, it wasn't the same thing. I give him credit for that.
Well, you know, this is one of the only, if not the only, Bond movies where he never fires a pistol.
In the whole movie,
the only firearm that he fires is that shotgun when he shoots the guy in the tree when they're hunting or they're shooting skeet or whatever. He never fires a pistol. But what does he have? Do you remember what he has instead in this movie?
It's like a compressed air thing.
He's got the little watch that shoots the darts.
Oh, yes. I love the watch.
And I love that I do too. I thought he should have had that in every movie. And I love that he's got like armor piercing shells and then cyanide tip shells. And he always has just the right one he needs
mm-hmm.
at any given moment. Like when he's in the centrifuge and he has to blow it up so he doesn't get killed, he has an armor piercing shell in it just randomly.
That's right.
And then when he goes after Drax, randomly he has, you know, the cyanide.
That's right.
So I do like that scene, though, where he corners Drax, and Drax is like, you know, I've been trying to kill you. I've been trying to you continue to thwart my attempts to give you an amusing death, Mr. Bond, you know, that kind of thing. And then he raises his hands and flips his wrist and shoots him with the little dart and then puts him out the airlock. I love that. I just think that's a really great ending for the villain. What'd you think about Dr. Goodhead as the Bond girl?
She was fine. I mean, I thought she was really good. You know, not as capable as the girl in Spy Who Loved Me.
No.
But I thought she was pretty good. What did you think?
Yeah, she's CIA. She's pretending to be like an astrophysicist or something for... She's a much better nuclear scientist than Denise Richards will be later in The World Is Not Enough. You got to give her that.
That's the truth.
Mira's a better nuclear scientist than Denise Richards in The World Is Not Enough. Yeah, she was all right. I like that she had her own little bag of tricks from the CIA. You know, instead of Felix Leiter, we get like the Bond girl being the CIA agent this time.
Yeah.
And she has like her poison pen that he uses to stab the snake, the extremely fake looking snake in the swimming pool in the jungle. And again, this movie recycles the same plot from the previous movie, The Spy Who Loved Me, but instead of starting a nuclear war, Drax is going to put those poison gas globules, you know, out of the shuttles, out of the space station, out into orbit to kill all the people, but leave the animals and plants alive so that he can come back down and repopulate the Earth somehow. So it's kind of similar to Stromberg's plot in the previous movie, but yeah, I you know what? Moonraker is one of those movies that I didn't like it very much at the time, but I find I like it more every year. It's moved up into probably my top 10, and I'm not sure it's done yet. It might keep moving up just because now that I know the parts that annoy me and I can kind of ignore them, I really enjoy the parts that are good. How do you rate it overall, kind of?
I mean, there are parts of this movie that I really, really love. Yeah. I mean, I love the boat chase scene in the jungle.
Yeah.
I just think there's a lot of the cool gadgets on the boat, and I like the fight. I like the fights with Jaws. I like the glass fight in Venice, like you were talking about. Mm-hmm. So I guess there are pieces of it I love, you know, as much as any movie. The whole is just doesn't do it for me, though. I think it's not one of my top five or six, but it is a good movie.
Yeah,
I mean, and also it has the kind of appeal that I saw it in the theater, maybe the first one I actually saw in the theater. So
yeah, that would fit about right, because the one before it's the first one I saw in the theater, but it was my brother that kind of dragged us to see it, so it would make sense that would, because I definitely saw it in the theater too. Let's put it this way, it's the first one I saw intentionally in the theater. You know, so that we're about the same age, so that would make sense. Okay, any last thoughts about Moonraker or any of the three before that?
No, other than maybe Jaws is the best sidekick of anybody. Just, he was so good.
He really was. Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty much between him and Odd Job, and it's pretty close between them. I mean, Jaws got to be in two movies. Mm-hmm. Odd Job only got to be in one, but Odd Job got to be in one of the best ones, and poor Jaws was getting two of the kind of mediocre ones, I guess, to some degree. But yeah, Jaws is right up there in terms of just one. You know, one sidekick, one henchman. He's pretty much he's the creme de la evil. These four are what I consider pretty much the good Roger Moores, and of course the next one we're going to talk about in our next episode for Your Eyes Only is a pretty good one too.
Yes.
After that, Roger Moore should have retired. That should have been his last goal. You know, his last hurrah. But alas, he did two more. All right, so I'm gonna do this part, this little segment now, real quick before we wrap up, and then I'll let you do it maybe in a future episode because you probably haven't prepared for this. This is something I could do. I'm gonna list my five favorite theme songs, and I'll see what you think about it, and maybe you can come up with your list sometime in the future when you've had a chance to think about it. I'm going to say of the various, I got to give honorable mention to the Goldfinger theme, which is so iconic, but it's not in my top five. It's a little too annoying. The Thunderball theme is also very iconic, but a little too annoying. And From Russia with Love is a great song, but not in my top five. My number five favorite Bond theme song is Tomorrow Never Dies.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's Sheryl Crow. It's just, it's to me, it's like the only one of the Pierce Brosnan theme songs that's actually really good. I don't like the GoldenEye song with Tina Turner just very much. My number four favorite theme song is On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which is an instrumental, but it's just so, the tempo, the action, dung 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 dung, you know, I just love that. I love that. It's really great. My number three is the classic Live and Let Die, because we didn't really mention the song.
No, it's a great song.
Oh, it's got such a great song. It was like the first real rock and roll theme song for a Bond movie. That also set it apart from what had come before. And, you know, Paul and Linda McCartney and Wings. But, you know, that reminds me of one other thing I wanted to mention about Live and Let Die. I love how in a lot of the Bond movies, they incorporate little strains of the theme song into the score all the way through it.
Oh, yeah.
But no movie does that more effectively to me than Live and Let Die, because like that, you know, the main little tune of Live and Let Die is so in your face. It's not that Goldfinger, duh, duh, but it's kind of like that, you know. And when there's a scene where Rosie Carver and Bond are on the island in the jungle. And all of a sudden she screams and Bond turns around. There's that scarecrow thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it does that Live and Let Die instrumental. I can't even do it, but it blasts that out. And that's very effective. It's creepy and memorable.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it is good. I mean, it's a great song and it's, you know, they do use it well in that movie all the way through.
Yeah, I think so. My number two favorite theme song is Moonraker. Where they bring back the same I can't ever think of people's names, as you know, but the lady that did Goldfinger came back to do Moonraker, and I think that's an awesome. It's a little slower, but it's just very, it fits the whole idea of the outer space theme and all that. And then I think the number one with a bullet, the number one best theme song is You Only Live Twice. And I love that one so much that I actually went and downloaded from iTunes the whole You Only Live Twice soundtrack, the score. And they use it all the way through it, and it's so good. It's so good. So, yeah, I recommend the You Only Live Twice soundtrack. So, and if you don't have it, you can get – there's a double CD of the 50th anniversary Bond scores that has all the theme songs on it along with other music. So it's really good. Really good investment. You get all 23 theme songs, or at least 20. I don't know if you get. Now you probably don't get Skyfall by Adele, but you can get that for like a dollar on iTunes. So, okay. Any last Bond thoughts for this week?
No, it's a lot of good movies, and I've really enjoyed going back and watching them as we prepare to talk about this. It's been fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now we'll get through. Next time we will get through Octopussy and before I left one out, we'll get through For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy, mm-hmm. and the dreadful A View to a Kill, and then Timothy Dalton riding a cello case or whatever that is down the side of a mountain on snow with Olivia Dabo in Living Daylights, and then the 1980s come to a close with License to Kill, where he goes against Central American drug lords or whatever, Latin American drug lords. So kind of a departure. So, all right. Well, like I said, check out the Facebook group for this topic, facebook.com/agentsandspies. And as always, visit the company that brings the show to you, White Rocket Books, at www.whiterocketbooks.com. And otherwise, John, I guess the rocket will get on out of here for another week, and we will come back next time to continue our Roger Moore and tour. So thanks a bunch for being on.
Looking forward to doing it again.
All right, and we will see you all down the road.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek. classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.